Welcome to University Showcase. I'm Megan Kamrick. In a one-year average, more than 116,000 people in America are shot by guns. These include murders, assaults, suicides, and suicide attempts, unintentional shootings, and police interventions. That grim statistic provides the backdrop for a new exhibit at the Maxwell Museum of Anthropology here at the University of New Mexico, Gun Violence, A Brief Cultural History. It's at the Maxwell Museum through November 10th. I have with me today the two curators of this exhibit, Devra Romanek and David Phillips. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Yeah, good to be here.
Why explore this issue in an anthropology museum?
The Maxwell Museum is the only people museum on campus. And this is a topic that rivets a national attention right now with a great deal of division. One of the lessons of anthropology is very often a social problem has more than one solution. And as you look around the world, cultural variability tells you possible solutions for a problem. So why not take it on as an anthropology museum?
And I'll add on to that I had started a series as curator of exhibits on contemporary issues in anthropology, because anthropology is a study of human cultures, and that includes our deep past, but also our present moment. And our deep past reflects our present moment, but to really engage visitors, sometimes it's good to talk about what's going on, even though it may be difficult and it may be controversial, you know.
Many of the Maxwell exhibits focus generally on world history, but our history in New Mexico. So talk about the significance of guns and our history here in New Mexico.
This morning's newspaper, when I opened it up, was all about how someone had taken hostages in a Chinese restaurant in Albuquerque and wound up being shot as the police intervened. And this is all too common an event in this country and even in New Mexico. I just came back from a few days in Taos, and up there the newspaper was talking about how there had been a drive-by shooting in northern New Mexico. It's a pervasive part of our society, and it's unfortunate. And we obviously need solutions, but no one seems to be able to agree on what the solution is.
So in addition to this moment that we're in, though, there is this long history here in New Mexico. And for me, in the exhibition, the most interesting part is we don't display the guns or munitions. We display half-cast molds of these objects as a way to talk about the impact as opposed to focusing on the object. Because, you know, guns can be fascinating objects to people. They are interesting technological objects. So we have these casts, and we have a half-cast mold of a musket ball from San Gabriel de Yunque, so the, you know, original first colonial settlement near Santa Fe.
Right across from Ocalingue Pueblo.
And so musket ball that was retrieved in an archaeological dig, and it's just this small, you know, round half sphere, sort of like a full stop, a period. And it says so much in that way. It is the beginning of gun violence in New Mexico, the beginning of a huge cultural change in terms of how people engaged and how violence was the process of violence and struggle with the arrival of firearms.
It helps set the stage for the colonial conquest of New Mexico.
Yeah, it's the colonial intervention, and you could say conquest, but this is an ongoing thing.
Talking about the West, there was an interesting part of the exhibit that focused on cowboys and how sort of advertising for the Colt pistol totally changed our perception historically and in popular culture of what cowboys were.
Yes, we live with a highly distorted, highly romanticized image of the American West. The takeover of the West was essentially a military conquest, largely by United States infantry and cavalry, and there were a number of key battles along the way. One of the things that happened as the conquest proceeded was there was a huge demand for beef at various military posts, and essentially the Texas cattle industry then began spreading northward and westward in order to feed that demand. So it was an industry. And the laborers in this industry were cowboys. And at the time, they were generally looked down on. They were seen as laborers, very often drunks and drifters, and they weren't seen as romantic individuals at all. Then what happens is the the Western expansion ends, and the Western expansion passes from being a fact of American life to part of a myth for people who are living in industrialized towns and seeking a mythical earlier past that was simpler, that was truer, that resonated with them, unlike their job, for example. And the cowboy became a symbol of that, especially the lone drifter cowboy who comes into town and cleans it up and then rides on. That story contains some alienation that everybody feels in modern industrial society, but it's a story about how an individual can be empowered to change things. And so you have this big romantic fantasy that's created, and the Colt company and other companies capitalized on it because they wanted to sell guns to a population that no longer needed it to go hunting, which was the primary civilian use of guns up to that point. This is not saying that today's cowboys are either of those things, because you go to a ranch in New Mexico, the cowboys are hardworking. They are keeping the cows in good shape. They're rounding them up. They're branding them. It's hard work. I've done a little of it. I know how hard it is. But that really has no connection with either the conquest of the West or with this mythical gun-toting cowboy whose six-gun was the difference between good and evil.
Well, that is such an iconic trope in Western literature and films. I mean, it endures even to today.
It does, and it also taps into, I think, an even broader theme in the exhibition and the point of taking a look in a brief way, because it's such a vast topic in history, but taking a look at attitudes towards guns and the larger tendency to mythologize guns in this country, in America. Dave and I did some writing of our own on how museums are a part of that. Guns have been a part of museum collections basically from the start. The earliest museum collections, or the collections that became museum collections, were these cabinets of curiosities back in the 17th century in Europe. And in those collections, you find some guns. As I indicated, guns were these fascinating technological objects. They were often made very beautifully, and they changed the way we live. And I think there was a recognition of that, as soon as they arrived on the scene. And in that, they became objects also of prestige initially, very early on. And so they entered these collections. And then, moving forward in time, you have all these munitions from some of the larger wars and conflicts that after the wars, they had nowhere to go. And so many of these went into museum collections or even became the foundation of museum collections. And so you have all these firearms and munitions and other weaponry that get exhibited. And in that display, they do get romanticized and, you could say, to some degree, fetishized.
You noted that you don't really have almost no guns in this exhibit. You have molds. They're sort of these ghostly white molds. So yeah. What is the impact of having that instead of an actual firearm?
Well, the main thing is that if you have the actual firearm, people will come in and they'll be so fascinated with the firearm, they won't understand the message of the exhibit, which is really not about guns. It's about gun violence.
You also look at gun violence around the world.
Yes. And again, this is part of the message of anthropology, which is things that we think are constant, such as how we approach guns in this country, are in fact variable when you look at what other cultures do. Some cultures positively worship guns. There are certainly parts of Afghanistan and Pakistan along the border there where a man is not a man without a gun. And that's unfortunate, and it explains a lot of what happens there today. There are other parts of the world where guns are pretty much immaterial to who you are. And those places have very, very low rates of gun violence. So if there's that much variation in how human beings can relate to guns, that gives me hope that in this country we can vary how we relate to guns and maybe solve the problem of rampant gun violence.
Yeah, the larger idea was to give people here a greater basis for conversation about what might be possible, you know, what has been and what might be possible. And in looking at different places and different times and seeing that there are these other possibilities and that this is an issue that is, for many people, certainly very personal. It's obviously an issue that is political, but it is also hugely cultural. In terms of identity, we, in some of the examples we give here in the United States, a lot of gun culture is about identity. And we have that editorial from Charles Blow, who talks about growing up with guns and, you know,
In Louisiana. And he's African American.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And what kind of role it plays in terms of identity. And it can be very regional, it can be gendered, et cetera.
He's not anti-gun, but he also saw the decimation that could be wrought if you happen to have a firearm nearby.
That's right. And we give another example, the example of Australia, who, you know, roughly a little more than 20 years ago, a huge incident of mass shooting, gun violence, and they changed the laws. And they, in the year since then, they've had a 72% drop in gun violence. I mean, this is huge. And so to offer an example like that, to have the notion, you know, because in some very broad way, I think Australian culture is not so different than
our culture. I was going to say, it's kind of a macho culture, and right. It's extremely focused. I mean, aside from the coasts, you have this vast interior that's people ranching and with a lot of dangerous animals.
That's right.
And they,
the spiders.
Yeah, right. Snakes. And they have a lot of guns, but they changed. They did this huge gun buyback.
That's right. And hugely successful, you know. So change is possible. And it definitely requires conversation and the political will.
If you just tuned in, this is University Showcase on KUNM. I'm Megan Kamrick, and I'm talking with David Phillips and Deborah Romanek. They're curators of a new show at the University of New Mexico's Maxwell Museum of Anthropology called Gun Violence, A Brief Cultural History. It will be at the museum through November 10th. You know, one of the most affecting things in the exhibit for me is the ceramic baby shoes that are hanging. And they're by Ann Lewis with a very provocative title, This Is Who We Are.
Yeah. One of the things we do in museums is we express ideas and notions through the use of visual and material culture. So her piece, This Is Who We Are, really is a representation of a data set that 8.8 children every day are killed with guns in the United States. And so she represents that with the same number of, you know, pairs of baby shoes. And it's much more impactful than looking at a graph or a chart.
There's also, as you come in, the very first thing you see is this sort of eerie X-ray of a shoulder or an arm.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Deborah managed to round that up, so...
Yeah, I had seen in the papers after, I think it was the shooting in Las Vegas, there was a lot of reporting on the kind of damage automatic weapons can do to the human body and X-rays of that. And so I just thought that was really interesting to be able to see the actual damage to the human body, what happens through the X-ray. And I thought that that would be a good overarching image for the exhibition because it's the actual, you know, bodily, literal impact of gun violence.
It's like shrapnel all up and down the
in the arm and you see the bone broken. And that actually, that particular X-ray is, as a matter of fact, that is from a regular shotgun wound. That is not from an automatic weapon. The damage of an automatic weapon really obliterates the human body.
The one firearm you had was the one that was broken up?
Mm-hmm.
This was the Gardens for Guns program?
Yeah, that's a program that is run by New Mexicans to prevent gun violence. And they're located out of Santa Fe, and that's Miranda Viscoli and Kira Jones who do that program. I think in the time that they've been running that, they've bought back, I think, close to 800 guns, the 800 firearms. When they do that, they chop them up like that, and then they get repurposed. They are made by an artist into gardening tools.
You also touch on going all the way back to the very foundation of the country and how guns were acquired sometimes of people to have them?
Yes, and this gets into the whole Second Amendment debate. Early on, adult males were required to be parts of local militias because they were in a quasi-military state. It was a frontier. They were taking land away from the Indians. The Indians fought back. They were sometimes fighting with other Europeans. And so it was a fairly militarized society, as you would expect on a frontier. So there was some militarization of American culture even before the country declared its independence. In fact, if you think about what happened in this country when it declared its independence, you can see how that militarization of the culture kind of predisposed us to go ahead and boot out the English as opposed to trying to find a peaceful solution to our beef with the mother country.
The inclusion of that excerpt, that's from a relatively new book by the historian Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. And what she's doing there is she's putting the Second Amendment and, you know, the whole Constitution into context, and that this is what was happening at the time that this was written. And it's about many things, but among them, taking land from indigenous people and about maintaining slavery. This is also, you know, part of the situation. And so we have that excerpt about the Second Amendment, and not in the exhibition, but recently we did a program with William Briggs, who wrote a book also on gun violence through UNM Press, published through them. He does something similar. He goes through the history of the writing of the Constitution and specifically the Second Amendment, and makes it clear that in the way that this was written and at the time that this was written, it was not a settled issue. It was very contentious, and many compromises were made in the writing of it. And so the notion that there's some pure way to interpret this is a false notion.
What is your hope in terms of bringing people perhaps together to talk more about these issues, because it's one of those things that's so divisive? Do you think this exhibit might be able to foster that?
Well, we certainly hope that people will go home from the exhibit and think about what they saw and maybe talk to their family members or friends and maybe open up the door to dialogue in a way they didn't before. But this exhibit will have a very small impact on the national stage, of course. What needs to happen is for more and more places, other university museums, for example, other museums in general, to be less afraid to present this topic and help open up the dialogue, and for there to be other forms of dialogue across the country. I think there are some eminently practical solutions to some of the gun violence problems we have in this country, but we are so afraid to bring them up because we think we'll be attacked and no one will listen, that the dialogue that we need to have happen isn't happening. And it would be very good if it started to happen, because until it does, things will continue as they have, and then there'll be another massacre. It could be right here at UNM. Meanwhile, thousands of people will take their own lives or a family member's life in a non-mass murder, and it won't change. At some point, some things have to be decided, and in order for them to be decided, they have to be talked about.
That is an interesting point. People might not know about gun violence. There are about twice as many suicide deaths from guns as homicides.
That's one of the things that is not talked about a lot and is addressed in the exhibition. And it's not an anti-gun exhibition, but it is looking at what are the possibilities in terms of regulating guns, because guns are regulated. I mean, that is the case.
It's an anti-gun violence exhibit, Right. Saying we have a problem and we need to fix it. Obviously, the gun violence issue is not going to be fixed without addressing guns. And so there'll be a connection, but it's not like we're saying hunting is bad. I go out in the woods hiking all the time. I encounter hunters all the time. I have a great time talking to them. They're very patient about the fact that I just destroyed their peace and quiet they need to hunt. They're a good bunch of people. Hunting is part of the American way of life, just to name one example of a lawful and appropriate use of guns. Other people love to target shoot. It takes a great deal of skill and concentration, and not everyone can do it. I know. I tried. I was terrible at it. So it can be a sport. It can be a way of life without involving killing people. And that is what we would like to get at.
having the conversation really clarifies things and also makes it clear from, you know, in my own mind, I know, what do I want to do about this in my life? You know, and I think having those conversations really helps.
Well, I want to thank you both for coming and talking to us on University Showcase.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
That was Devorah Romanek and David Phillips. They're co-curators of Gun Violence, A Brief Cultural History. It's at the Maxwell Museum through November 10th. Now we go to the part of University Showcase where we highlight research you may not know about.
Nobody's ever gonna read this!
This is Marty Adam-Smith, afternoon freeform host, in the studio with UNM Professor of Architecture, Nora Wendell. How are you doing today, Nora?
I'm good. How are you?
Very well, thank you. So I decided on the name Nobody's Ever Going to Read This for this segment like 2+ years ago. And most people have been kind of like, sure, I'll do something that sort of implicitly makes fun of academia as a whole. But you were the first person who was actually excited to be on a show that is jokingly, half jokingly mm-hmm. at most, saying that people don't read academic writing. So talk to me about your background. Talk to me about being at UNM Architecture and like what your kind of work plan, like what your career is focused on right now.
Okay. So essentially, I was really excited to join your program because there's, in my own research, I've discovered or realized when I published an academic article in 2015 that uncovered the sort of sexist subtext of an architectural history, which recorded the patron of this glass house, Dr. Edith Farnsworth, as having been the rumored lover of her architect, Mies van der Rohe. I sort of traced that history and discovered that in many ways that narrative was covering for, you know, a reception of this experimental glass house, which wasn't very warm. The general public kind of regarded it with some suspicion, and also the fact that the glass house had a number of problems as an experimental structure. It flooded from the roof because the roof detailing wasn't exactly right, and it was built in a floodplain. So essentially, the sort of narrative of this love affair covers up the fact that there was a contentious lawsuit that ends up not settling entirely in the architect's favor, and a sort of history of this woman taking ownership of her relationship to the structure as not only a patron, but actually a client, somebody who had commissioned a structure and had certain expectations of it. So anyway, I write this history. I publish it in Thresholds, which is a journal that MIT puts out. And I felt very much like I had uncovered some nuances in the relationship and that I'd done a really good job of expressing exactly what I thought were the problems in the construction of that history, including the fact that it was based entirely on rumor. And generally, what I discovered was that when the article, which was published in an academic context, got picked up in two very well-read architecture blogs, I discovered that the sort of public reception was that it was much better to have like a trope. Like they really wanted, they liked the story, you know, and frankly, it's a story that if you visit the house is sold to you as, well, we can't prove it, but there may have been this love affair, you know, and I think that, you know, people gravitate toward like simple narratives. And so when you said, you know, are you interested in doing this program that makes fun of academia? I thought, well, yeah, I kind of am because, you know, while my academic colleagues told me they appreciated the article and while I felt, you know, really satisfied by the process of the research, being in Dr. Edith Farnsworth's archive, really uncovering the truth behind her idea of what the house was supposed to be and what she wanted it to be, I discovered that maybe the academic mode of publication and research wasn't really a way to change cultural narratives. That if really the work of the academic is to transform culture as much as we can in our time here, giving the public a 5,000-word essay that they were maybe going to spin through, you know, quickly, like scroll through and then say, well, I don't know, this is too complicated for me. I like the story of the shrewish woman and the heroic architect and the, you know, that she was angry for 20 years. I kind of prefer that topic or that plot structure. Some things haven't changed much. So I was given access to the trial transcript of the trial between the client and the architect that took place in 1952. when everybody was sort of examined and cross-examined. It's 4,000 pages long. And when I was allowed access to it, it's owned by an architect who lives in Chicago who's facilitating access to that document via the grandson of the architect. And when they gave me access to it, they made me promise and sign a document saying I would never quote directly from the transcript, and I would also never exhibit the transcript. And so,
wow.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that is almost like you can't do academic work with it.
Precisely.
So, I mean, what was their purpose in making it accessible to you?
Maybe to drive me nuts. I don't know. I guess to like give me the knowledge, but then not allow me to truly use that knowledge. And so because of that, that's why I began writing the book I'm writing in the mode of creative nonfiction, because you're right, precisely. Like, I know the content. I just am not allowed to express the content. As somebody who has a relationship to an institution where she's tenured, I mean, fortunately, there are avenues for funding. So
Sure. It's
an interesting dance of like saying, look, I'm rejecting the methodologies of the typical historian at this point, but I do like the funding. So to find that dance of saying, you know, producing this form of knowledge is still academic has been a really interesting dance for me. Could you talk more about
in terms of the atypical result of this process, could you talk more about your book,
The
Creative Nonfiction, written from the first person, if I recall correctly?
Yes. Talk
to us a little more about that.
Okay. That is a project that started, I think, 2 or 3 years ago when I was living in Portland, Oregon. I was starting to realize that there were ways in which telling the history of my writing this history was, in a weird way, more interesting than sometimes what I was finding, or more interesting than simply writing about the facts of it. So I wrote a first draft of the book and workshopped it last summer at Tin House in Portland, Oregon, which is a publisher puts on this very like elaborate workshop with artists and with writers mostly. So I workshopped it with Renee Gladman and Paul Isaacy, who's a memoirist. And I was nervous about it because I thought this is pretty atypical for a creative nonfiction book of like first novel length, you know, like 70 to 80,000 words. But they were both really receptive to it. And it made me realize that, you know, maybe the narrative of the love affair can go away if somebody can write a narrative that's just as compelling. And so I'm hoping that my narrative about like my embodied relationship to this woman, both in terms of like my own life and my own relationships, her life and her relationships, and then the sort of triangulated relationship of me learning about her through the institutional structures of power that control knowledge in my discipline. I'm hoping that maybe that can replace the sort of very simple story of the love affair. We'll see.
Very cool. Well, I wish you the best of luck with
it,
Nora.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
That was Marty Adams-Smith with Nora Wendell, Associate Professor with the School of Architecture and Planning at UNM. You can hear this and all our episodes of University Showcase at KUNM.org. Thanks to Associate Professor David Bashwinner for composing our theme music. I'm Megan Kamrick. Thanks for listening to University Showcase.